Hello, I'm James Sandy, and this is the New Curiosities Box, a monthly sort through the best in arts and culture from Birmingham and beyond. In this programme, we seek the balance between rock and folk and between protest and passion as I speak to Thea Gilmore backstage prior to her recent gig at the Mac. We consider the return of a veteran wall builder and bass-wielding anarchist in a check of the new album from Roger Waters, as well as some of the other troubling artefacts that have recently hit our shelves. And we take a rollercoaster ride through fear, anxiety and consequences with the aid of Idiot Child Theatre as they bring dark comedy to the Mac with What Happens If the Plane Falls Out the Sky. You can catch up on all of the shows so far or enjoy a repeat listen through the blog. thenewcuriositiesbox.blogspot.co.uk. Fresh out of the gate, speeding after her new release on cooking vinyl, The Counterweight, we start with words of wisdom from Thea Gilmore. Okay, so I'm going to watch my words carefully because, according to The Independent, I'm with the best wordsmith of her generation, Thea Gilmore. That's an introduction, isn't it?
Yeah, isn't it though? Yeah. Well, I'm not sure I agree, but...
But what a great thing. What a great thing to have as a...
Yeah, it's very, very nice. But you've got to try really hard not to listen to reviews and just get on with what you're doing, to be honest.
Now, and what you are doing tonight, you're touring your new album, which I think came out very recently, about the 2nd of June, I think.
That's right, yeah.
So only 4 days in to it being sort of in people's ears. And it's called The Counterweight.
It is, yeah.
Which is a kind of, I guess it's a kind of, in some ways, a companion piece. Is that fair? But tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, I made an album in 2003 called Avalanche, and I was 23 years old at the time. And I was, you know, a cynical girl, a sort of young 20-something, and was taking a bit of a grumpy look at what was going on in the world. And that album kind of touched on all sorts of things, from the apathy I thought my generation felt to, you know, anything political or kind of socially motivated. And it was just one long grump. I really like it, but it's, you know, it was sort of an album of a type. But this new album comes from a similar place. I had been making records up to now that are kind of a bit more introspective, maybe albums that are kind of, you know, about parenthood and about depression and about, all, you know, love, I suppose, lots of that. I was writing in 2016, and how can you not respond to what was going on at that time and all the incredible sort of changes that went on in the world? And so the album is a response to that, and in being a response to that is very much a sort of sister album to Avalanche in terms of the way that it views the world, I suppose.
Now, you used the word there, grump. I think it's a good description. That could be a new genre, couldn't it? You know?
Yes, so, grump rock.
Yeah, grump rock. I think now that could have legs, actually. I think there is an element, I guess, to sort of folk or traditional music. Not that that's exclusively what you do, but is about protest or is about angst. And you're trying to explore that, I think, this time in quite an interesting way, because you've put to one side the traditional weapons of the acoustic guitar and you've started using a piano and iPad mix.
Yeah, well, I've made a lot of records, you know. There's an awful lot of my albums out there, and I think that if you don't try new things, I should probably say I don't actually play piano, so it was quite a challenge.
I read that and I wondered, you know, how the tour was going.
Well, luckily for me, you know, I put the ideas down and I get the notion of the song, and I can write the song on the piano, but I don't play it live because that would be a car crash. Nobody would want to hear that. They would want their money back. But I can play it enough to write to. But it, you know, it does bring up quite a few sort of oddities in terms of, because I'm not musically trained, I don't read music, it kind of changes the way that you write on an instrument if you don't know the instrument or understand the instrument or even understand the sort of, you know, the complexities of the theory of music. And I think it, you know, it makes it a bit more unusual, and I kind of like that. I like the challenge. I like not constantly making the same record twice.
And there's some tracks on the album I want to ask you about. So there's a new single, which is cunningly called New. Yeah. So that's confusing already.
Yes.
And that's out currently. But there's a track, there's a couple of tracks I wanted to ask you about. There's one track that sticks out, and I've been listening to the album over the last few days. It's a track called Reconcile.
Right. Okay?
And I think bravely you've decided, correct me if I'm wrong, but you've decided to take on the whole Brexit, or partly the Brexit agenda. And interestingly, I spoke to Boo Hoodine last year and asked him about Brexit and how you tackle that and so on. And he said he couldn't get his head around it. So you're kind of on the leading edge of doing things, I think.
Well, yeah, I mean, I suppose I decided to tackle the idea of Brexit from the point of view of how disconnected we have all become from each other because of technology and the way that we use it. Now, I'm not a technophobe. I love technology. I tweet and I Facebook and I find it really interesting. But I think that it is a perfect breeding ground for disconnection, for people to disconnect from their communities. And as soon as you disconnect from your community, you start to only see things from your own point of view. Facebook and Twitter are echo chambers in themselves. And so I think it's a perfect breeding ground for division. And so Reconcile is very definitely about the way that we've all sort of been kind of just rocked into this little stupor of kind of only understanding ourselves and our own point of view. And I think that Brexit is a product of exactly that. It's a product of seeing things very much from one perspective and not being able to see other people's points of view. You know, people are a bit prone to that anyway. It's kind of part of human nature. But because we live our lives online an awful lot now, you just don't see anything else. You just see what you want to see. And Reconcile was my response to that, really.
And there's an interesting nuance in that. So from what you just said, I'm not going to label you a Luddite. So you're not anti-technology. But what you're saying, I think, is it's very much about the kind of articulation, about the application of technology and perhaps things it is replacing that we need to kind of rethink about bringing back, you know, talking to your neighbour, that kind of simple stuff.
Yeah, it sounds very kind of old-fashioned in a way, but I think the problem is that humans evolve a lot slower than technology does, and we are at a point where we are still cavemen and technology's off there sort of, you know, conquering galaxies. And I think we need to accept, I think we need to try and accept that we can't possibly evolve as quickly as technology. And so we have to bring it back down to a slightly more human scale. I think it's wonderful. I think that the things that you know, technology has brought to us is extraordinary. And I think the internet is a wonderful tool, but that's exactly what it should be, a tool, not a master. That's, you know, it's what I wrote in the song and it's what I really feel. So.
Yeah. Now, I've read also about your approach to music and to songwriting. And I think I'm right in saying that you don't perhaps plan it perhaps meticulously or you don't sort of have a schedule or a timetable. You just kind of you try and sort of react or you get the spontaneity of things in terms of your approach. Is that fair to say?
Oh, that's very fair. Yeah, I think there are two types of writer. I always use my two favourite songwriters as examples of each type. You've got Bob Dylan, who is a complete sort of, it just appears and it's as if by magic. And then you've got Leonard Cohen, who sweats over every line of every song. And neither one is better than the other. Neither one is the right way to do it. But they both create beautiful work, but it's a very definite difference in the way that people write. And I'm very definitely, it just sort of plops out there and it arrives. Songs arrive fully formed very often. If I spend longer than, you know, a couple of days perfecting a song, I feel like it's too long. And I have a really short attention span. A really short attention span. I'm working on it, but that's why I write songs, not books, because my attention's rubbish.
I feel so new. It's all beginning, it's a game on.
Interestingly, there's a song on the new album, The Counterweight, which I guess has acquired more resonance than perhaps maybe you initially intended. And there was a coincidental element to it, which was Johnny Gets a Gun is the track. And that coincided with the sad news about the murder of Joe Cox, the MP, during the referendum. Now, that's a difficult place or difficult light to cast on a song, isn't it? Because I think you were sort of writing or finishing it as that occurred.
Yeah, well, the song had actually been written, but what happened was the day that we were recording it in the studio, we started to record it and all our phones in the studio sort of went off with news headlines that she'd been attacked. And then by the time we'd finished, she'd obviously passed away. And yeah, I mean, obviously, in essence, the first thing you think is, oh my God, that's utterly tragic. But as time went on and I sort of thought about the fact that we were recording that particular song on that particular day, it did acquire a bit more resonance than I intended. I mean, it's a song that I wrote in response to watching a documentary on Columbine, actually. And sort of, you know, looking at gun culture and the way that America sort of responds to its gun culture around children particularly. But yeah, of course, now I play it and it rips my stomach out because I can't not think about what was going on the day we recorded it.
I think it's really interesting how songs can do that, how they can catch a mood. You know, the kind of timing of them isn't always intentional, but
I think a lot of my favourite albums are real reflections of the time that they were made in, and it, like you say, it wasn't necessarily a kind of I'm going to make a record about our times. It was just they just were products of it and therefore sort of explained it better than anything else could.
Now, you mentioned earlier, and you are a hard-working artist, you've made a lot of albums. You've done a lot of live shows, but you've made a lot of albums. And I was going to ask you, you've done sort of interpretations and covers of other work, and you've done a lot of, I guess, collaborations, if you like. So you've worked with people like Sandy Denny and Joan Baez and people like that. And I you mentioned Leonard Cohen, who sadly obviously passed last year, which I think, you know, many people are still trying to get their heads around that happening. I was going to ask you, are there people out there who've got on your list of working with, or is that part of the planning that perhaps you haven't got around to yet?
Yeah, no, I don't really plan it. Do you know what? I'm not sure that I like having worked with the people that I've worked with. That's great. But I always get really nervous about the thought of working with my absolute heroes, because I look at like someone like Tom Waits, for example, and particularly his wife, Kathleen Brennan, who they write as a team. And I think I would love to meet them and I'd love to write with them. And then I think, I'm not sure I would actually, because I think there is a point with your absolute heroes where I don't really want to know any more than I already know. I don't want to know what they have for breakfast, and I don't want to know. I like that mystery. Mm. It's something that I am really at odds with in terms of the times that we live in, because everyone wants to know everything about their favourite celebrities, and I really don't. I want to know the music they make, and anything else, not interested. In fact, I feel more connected to their music if I don't know anything about them. So it, part of me, the writer in me, is like, no, you really want to write with Tom Waits, of course you do. And then the rest of me is like, no, just leave him as being a hero, and that's fine.
And in terms of that music, I was considering, you've done a lot of, I think, songs that are very well known, quite popular songs. They're pop yeah. songs, aren't they, essentially? Do you think, are there things that you wouldn't go near? Are there things you wouldn't sort of attempt to cover or attempt to sort of reinterpret?
I tend, in terms of covers, I don't really see the point of covering something unless you can bring something completely you to it. A lot of people ask me to cover Dylan records, and I have done it in the past. I've actually recorded an entire Dylan album in the past, but I only did the ones where I felt like I had something new to give to it. there's simply no point in me covering, you know, a Joni Mitchell song, for example, because she's done the definitive versions. She, you know, she's a woman. She's, if I were a bloke, that would be different. You could bring a sort of male perspective to her songs, and that's different. But there's just no point. So if I get asked to cover something, I look at it and I think, well, can I bring something new to this? And if I can, then I'll give it a go and see what happens.
Now, at the moment, you're touring the length and breadth of the United Kingdom, doing most of the corners, I think. Are you doing a good good spread of the map?
Missing out Scotland.
But its time will come, I'm sure.
It will.
You know, we'll get that in the diary at some point. And it's very much a family affair, isn't it, at the moment? I'm sensing that from where we're sitting. And that's obviously changed, that part of, you know, being an artist and a performer. In terms of, you know, baggage isn't the right word, but you know, the more things you acquire in life, the complexities.
Yeah.
How have you found that? Is that something that enriches the experience, or?
Oh, it completely enriches it. I mean, it makes life a lot more difficult. Having children is you know, it completely turns an artistic lifestyle on its head in some respect, and in other respects, it just makes you more. It makes you more organised, which is a good thing for me. But it makes you more assertive, I think, and kind of more definite about how you're going to do things and what you want to do, because every move you make has to be much more carefully orchestrated. And just from a writing perspective as well, it's made me far more intense and far more, again, assertive, stroke aggressive in some respects, but also much more willing to see the lightness in things, or try and find the lightness, try and find a bit of kind of humility or a bit of light in what I'm writing about, because you don't want to be writing, you know, end of days songs when you're looking at your two kids and thinking you've got to inherit this mess that we're making here. So yeah, that mixture of kind of real assertion and wanting things to change, but also trying to go, but it's all right, you know, here's the hope, here's what we can do, trying to find some way of picking your way through the ashes and you know, making things okay.
And do they become part of the kind of pre-show ritual meditation, if you like, or do they get in the way of things that perhaps you might have done to prepare before?
No, well, both.
Okay.
Both, yeah. You just have to, you know, everything alters. You just have to accept that. I mean, I find it quite hard in some respects because I am a mother first. There's no getting around that. I'm a mother first, and I find it when I'm doing sound check, if something happens, if one of the kids falls over, or if they want something, my brain just goes straight into, okay, what do you need? And I can't, you know, some people are really good, they're completely steely, and it's just, nope, you're over there and you're doing that, and this is my job now. But I can't do that. I'm a mother first and singer-songwriter second, and it was that ever since, you know, I became pregnant with my first, and that's the way it is. And I'm okay with that, you know, that's all right. I'm kind of happy there.
I think that's a very positive attitude. I think that's a very positive position to be in, I think. If only all rock and roll stars could be in that place. But
well, most of them have, you know, full-time nannies, so yeah. they don't have to worry about it.
So, Theo Gilmore, thanks very much for your time. We're going to enjoy the show tonight. And folks, if you can't catch Theo on tour, then you can catch The Counterweight, which has just been released. Thank you, Theo.
Cheers,
thanks.
For more links to Theo Gilmore's work, her upcoming tour dates, videos, and more background information, you can go to her website, theogilmore.net. This is the New Curiosities Box, and I'm James Sandy. Now, what if your worst fears realised themselves in unexpected places? What if you didn't realise that they were your worst fears? This level of anxiety caught me head on when I tried to unravel the mysteries of What If the Plane Falls Out of the Sky with co-director of Idiot Child Theatre Company, Susie Riddell.
Okay, so I'm with Susie Riddell, who I'm very excited to be with, because we're talking about, I think, well, an intriguing piece, and it's billed as kind of dark comedy, humour, and those are things that appeal to me greatly.
Good.
So we're talking about something called What If the Plane Falls Out of the Sky? It's quite a provocative question. So do you want to start explaining what that is?
Yes. Well, it's a show. It's a piece of theatre, which is also very funny, which explores fear and anxiety and how that can cripple us and stop us from doing things that we really want to do, like sometimes like getting on a plane. The title comes from our director and writer of the show, Anna Harpin, who I co-run the company with, Idiot Child, because she was absolutely terrified of flying. sort of terrified, like Mr. T, basically, go that strong. So was looking at different therapies to cure her of that, drugs. you know, lots of people have all a strong stuff. Whiskey before they get on a flight. Yes. Hypnotherapy, self-help, mindfulness, all those things that people use today to try and cure us of our horrible, crippling anxieties. And I think she's a lot calmer with planes now. The show is not about fear of flying.
It's
touched upon.
Yes.
But it's about lots of other things. Because fear and anxiety ranges from stuff, death, you know, that's the big one, isn't it, really? That's all in the back of all our minds. But other things like spiders, and not wanting to pick up the phone and make a phone call because you're not feeling in the right mood.
Is it about irrational fear, or is it about how we rationalise things and become scared of them?
I think it's about both of those things. I think fear, it's important to have fears and anxieties, isn't it? Otherwise we'd all just be killing ourselves.
Yes,
doing very risky things. But a lot of fears are irrational. Well, they come from somewhere, though. They come from something rational. And I think what we found in doing the show in lots of different places and talking to because we talk to the audience a lot. It is an interactive piece of theatre. That's not to be, don't be afraid of
that. No, don't put people off.
Yeah, it's not, you know, it's not like a panto. But we do talk about, we ask people what their fears and anxieties are. And the interesting thing has been that a lot of them are the same. And a lot of times people think, on an instant reaction, they say, oh, well, I haven't got any. Because you might think of fear of flying, fear of heights, fear of snake. No, I haven't got any of those things. But actually, they might have fear of very different, more existential things that you need to think a little bit about before you can speak about them.
So is there an element of the production which is about, I guess, there's two things that strike me when I'm sort of reading around this and kind of looking at how this is pitched. One is it's partly perhaps about technology in the sense, not a fear of technology, but how that's kind of fed anxiety and angst. And the other thing that struck me, these are big questions, but the other thing that struck me is there's something about sort of childhood and the innocence of perhaps how we filter things.
They're two very interesting points actually directly in relation to the show. I'll deal with the first one first. the characters in the show, the premise is there's three siblings who their parents left 19 years ago and they've never left the house, these siblings. So they've come up with a system of a therapy system to cure the world of anxiety. So they haven't actually got any knowledge really past 1992-ish. So technology hasn't really hit them in the same way that for an audience that is very present, and I would completely agree with you because I think my phone is a great source of anxiety when I've got it in my hand, but also when I haven't. That panic. I haven't got my phone. What am I going to do? I can't survive.
Have you ever forgotten your phone?
Oh God, yeah, it's awful.
And then you can survive without it, can't you?
You can absolutely, and it's quite liberating, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes.
So we should all chuck them away for a couple of hours and then get them back. But I think that is a valid point. I think that comes up when we've talked to audiences about what they're afraid of. And that constant pressure, it's a pressure that the whole of society is under to be happy all the time and to be in control and for everything to be fine. And it's completely unrealistic, isn't it? Because sometimes we're not in control and we can't be happy all the time. It's just not possible. So we kind of explore that in it. But the childhood thing is strong in the piece because although these are adults, they really haven't fully grown up and they haven't had proper proper childhoods. They were my character's the oldest and the parents left when she was about 17. So she'd kind of taken her two younger siblings under her wing. I think childhood fears stay with us. I've got a vivid memory of thinking that Wurzel Gummidge lived down the side of my bed. Single bed, so I only slept in about 15 centimetres of my bed for about 10 years of my life because I was always thinking it was down there.
I think it was always the Crow Man that gave me the jitters from that programme.
Terrifying
programme. It was
programme.
A strange one. So really I guess what you're saying is there's something here about consequences and consequences of things that have happened worrying people, but equally people just being increasingly anxious about the kind of what ifs.
Yeah, oh yeah, you know, a what if is a major...
And things may never happen, you know, it may never happen, but...
We play things out in our head, and that is an important thing to do. Like I said before, you've got to do that to kind of know what the risks are. But we do, at the start of the show, there's a section where it's when the audience go, oh yeah, I feel like that. Oh yeah, I feel like that. Oh, I've not heard that one before. Because we talk about what if, what if the plane falls out of the sky? What if you need the toilet and you're sat in the middle of the row and you have to cross the stage to leave? It's things that, what if I can't find the toilet? You know, and we do that all the time, the what if this, what if that, and often our what if worries never come to fruition. And that can stop us from actually moving forward in life. It sounds very serious. It sounds like a very serious piece.
It does sound very serious.
But it is actually very, very funny. But within that comedy, there are moments of real tenderness and moments of recognition. These characters are quite unusual. They're quite odd, but they're recognisable and they have a humanity. And they have fears and feelings that you and I would recognise. Mm. So you feel for them and you want them to be okay. So I think that's where our work, that's what we like, that's what we do. We create unusual worlds, but we are exploring things that are very, very human and shared by everybody. So it kind of, by having that comedy, you can really hit some quite serious topics, because you can't just go straight in with these children, these people have had horrible lives. It's too much. You need to go at it from a different angle, I think, and it makes it more hard hitting, really. Mm. Once you've let them in.
So let's talk about the comedy element.
Yes.
Comedy is notoriously difficult to write and deliver and to get a good return. I'm not putting any pressure on, but get a return on. But I'm interested in terms of the process for that. So from what you've said, a number of things are, I guess, anecdotal.
Yeah.
And there's a good slug of sort of improvisation about about the piece. But how does that sort of sit, if you like, with the kind of structure and the writing of the show? What's the balance? How does it spark? How do you find something that's funny?
Yeah, well, Anna Harpin writes the work with, and we spend a lot of time doing improvisations and just chatting. It all comes from autobiography, really, essentially. And also, our audiences have helped us with these unusual things, the what if questions. Because in the development of the piece, we had a little stand at the Bristol Old Vic, and we asked people to write down their what ifs. So quite a few of the things that you'll hear in the show have come from that. Comedy, Anna's very funny. we just have to try things out, I suppose. And a lot of it is improvised. When we're talking to the audience, you just have to go with it. And often you get some real gems, what people say
to you. So I guess the show kind of develops as you tour?
Definitely. Yeah. Things change with different venues because different spaces present different challenges, different opportunities. Yeah, and you just don't quite know what's going to happen. Of course, this is a fully scripted piece, but then there are moments of audience interaction, and that's when, you know, anything could happen. So the show's never the same twice, definitely. And comedy, yeah, you just have to keep trying stuff out, I think. And they're strong characters, a lot of it's character driven.
Is there a kind of defiance about that comedy where you think, this is funny, you will laugh at this?
No, I think that's always awful. I mean, yeah, not to say that I've sometimes thought, what is wrong with you? This is hilarious. No, but you just can't. Some shows, it's hysterical. People are, you know, literally rolling about. And then other shows can be very, very quiet. And it doesn't mean they're not enjoying it. It just means there might not be a big laugher in the audience to set everybody off, or they're just taking different things from it. You don't have to laugh, you know, it doesn't fall or succeed on the number of laughs that we get. And there are moments that are definitely very much not funny. And the silences after those are quite magical.
So there's an element of fear, isn't there, in what you're describing there? There's a kind of fear in the...
Oh, I'm terrified.
In the delivery as well. You're taking the show to Edinburgh Fringe, which is very exciting.
Yes.
And you're kind of touring up until that and around that.
Yes, we've been touring for the last 5 weeks or so. We started in Bristol. We've been to London, Brighton, Weston-super-Mare. We just wanted to go places with the seaside,
Weston-super-nightmare, as a friend of mine calls it. Anyway.
It's actually very nice. And where else? We were at Exeter last week. And then we've got one night here in Birmingham. Then we're in Guildford next Wednesday, and then Oxford. And then we've got a month off, and then we go to Pleasance at the Edinburgh Festival for the whole festival, which is sort of 25 shows in a row. We've got a really good time slot. It's 4:20 p.m. and the show is 70 minutes long, and you get a free mojito and snacks during the show. We do look after the audience. I might ask you a couple of questions, but we do make sure you're comfortable as well.
I don't want to devalue the piece, but that's got to be worth it alone, isn't it?
Exactly! we hope it'll tempt the Edinburgh audience anyway. We hope it's a piece that's going to go really well at the festival, that people are kind of up for new work. That is a bit risky, perhaps, because when you're talking to an audience, you are taking a bit of risk, and they are too, but we do, it's not in any way, we don't put any pressure on the audience, and it's a caring, it's a sharing of ideas rather than you will laugh, you must respond to this. I think that's what theatre is. It's about communication.
Is it that really very British ideal of kind of supportive self-deprecation? Is it that kind of idea?
We are self-deprecating. The only people who get, you know, the Mickey taken out of them are the characters.
People are safe, is what you're saying.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. There's a. You're as safe as you want to be. There is an opportunity for you to come up on stage. There's actually a couple of seats on stage you can come and sit at and have some sweets, but there's absolutely no obligation to do that. And I hope that we create an environment where people feel comfortable to be involved. And I love it when people heckle and say things and get involved. I think it's great. It's what it should be about.
Excellent. Now, you touched on the name of the company, Idiot Child.
Yes.
Which I think you kind of hail from Bristol, or you're kind of based in Bristol, sort of,
yep.
Ostensibly.
Now, based in Bristol.
So Idiot Child's an interesting name.
Yeah, so explain it.
Explain it and explain a little bit about the company behind, you know, sort of that.
Well, Idiot Child, the company name has come about, it took us a long time to think of something that was suitable, but it's because we are playful, like children, and peculiar. Like idiots. So we're Idiot Child. And I kind of say it now without any, you know, when words lose their meaning. So I say it without, and then I realise that somebody else like yourself might go, oh, that's a bit strange. But we hope it's quite memorable as well. We create all our own work. It's all new. And it's myself and Anna Harpin, who is also, she's an associate professor of theatre at Warwick University. So she's quite busy at other things as well. But we're based in Bristol, and we've had great support from the Bristol Old Vic. They have a programme of new writing called Ferment. So we've kind of come through their Ferment programme, and the Arts Council have been very helpful as well, which is great. And this is our third production. We've gone from a one-man show to a two-hander, and now we've got three people in this, so it's expanding,
it's growing,
and
it's growing.
Our biggest tour to date. But I'm actually a Brummie, so I left Birmingham about 8 years ago, but my family are still, they're all coming tonight.
You've got fond Mac memories.
Oh yeah, I mean, my Mac connection starts when I was about seven doing pottery classes here, and I was a member of the Central Junior Television Workshop, which quite a few actors have come out of, including Samantha Morton is probably the most famous. She was in the Nottingham Workshop. But that started here at the Mac. And I've done loads of shows in the Hexagon, and I've worked with Odd Socks, who are a big Mac company. They're based in Derby, and they come and do shows in the arena in the main theatre. Yeah, I love the Mac, and I'm really, really excited to be here. A bit too excited, possibly.
Too excited.
I need to calm down.
Now, also, there will be folks listening to this interview who listen to other radio stations as well who may recognise your voice.
Oh, I don't know if they
from a popular, I guess it is a soap, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's the longest running radio soap in the world.
So we're talking about The Archers. So you've got a part in The Archers.
Yeah, I play Tracy Horobin. So actually, I'm hoping that nobody recognises my voice from this interview, because she doesn't speak the same as me at all. She's quite a character, and it's great fun to play her. And it's an honour, actually, to be part of that show, because it's great. But I was in it over 20 years ago as well, as a child, playing a completely different character. I used to play Kate Aldridge when I was 11 to the age of about 16. And then 17 years later, come back as, on a very different end of the social spectrum, I have to say. Because Kate's like kind of landed gentry, and Tracy isn't. But she's great. She's great fun.
Quite a contrast to what you're up to here, isn't it?
Completely. The Archers and Idiot Child I mean, there's comedy and theatre in both. That's the link. But yeah, it's quite a different style, which I love. I love the fact that I can do so many different things. That's the joy of being a performer and of making your own work as well. You've got to get up and do something and make it yourself.
It's great stuff. Now, I'm looking forward to tonight's performance. I shall be there.
Good.
Whether I'm humiliated in some way, I don't know.
You won't be humiliated. Please don't think you're going to be humiliated.
I'll try not to.
You'll have a free drink. You'll be fine.
But when you get to the Edinburgh Fringe, best of luck with that.
Thank you.
And thanks for your time. And enjoy the other points on the map until you get up to the top of the country.
Thank you very much.
Excellent. Susie, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Cheers.
This is the New Curiosities Box, and I'm James Sandy. We move now to a new release from veteran rocker Roger Waters. His new album, Is This the Life We Really Want?, is his first in 24 years, since 1992's Amused to Death. It's his fifth studio album. And for a concept album, it's bigger on reality than it is on concept. It's produced by Nigel Godrich, he who makes Radiohead bleep with reason and purpose. Is it new ground or old ground? Well, it's more probably a case of ground re-examined with a well-focused lens. His voice is well used, it's matured, it's cracked, it's definitely recognisable by hardened Pink Floyd fans. It was recorded across the last 7 years by Roger Waters, who now is a staggering 73 years old. Is he tired? No. Is it depressing? Not really. But it is dark and it is cutting, but it has vigour and it has purpose. Waters himself is never far from controversy or a heated debate. There's even a move to boycott the man himself. He gives voice to rage and he gives voice to passion. It's a great album, and in some way it's an adjunct to the great The Wall. If you've never heard The Wall, go out and find a copy and play it on loop. That's my advice. We're going to play a track now from the new Roger Waters release. This You may think you've heard this before, and I guess that's kind of the point. This is a track called Deja Vu. Now, what would you do if you had a kooky electronic folk sound and had two successful albums, but wanted to stretch out a little bit? Well, in the case of Alt-J, they've gone a little bit off message. Their recent album, The Relaxer, has met with mixed reviews, but if you bear with it, I think it's worth further investigation. Certainly this track is a little bit of an eye-opener. Less a cover version, more a mist of intrigue. This is their version of The House of the Rising Sun. Out now on Infectious Music, that's Alt-J. If you've got an idea for a future show or an event that you're running that you'd like us to cover, you can get in touch via our blog, thenewcuriositiesbox.blogspot.co.uk. And now a quick catch up on those gigs and festivals happening between now and our next show. Tilt 17 on the 17th to the 23rd of July is a 5-day aerial and physical theatre festival with performances from national and international circus artists. There'll be outdoor shows, masterclasses, and family friendly performances. You can find more information at tiltfestival.com. The Rep will be hosting the Bee Festival 2017 until the 8th of July, a mix of theatre, dance, comedy, music, visual and performing arts. If you're quick, you can catch an array of performances and site experiences, and even an opportunity to explore the Rep backstage. Check out more details at beefestival.org, and we'll be covering some of that festival in our next show. If you fancy a bit of crooning, why not catch Top Loader at the Jam House on the 20th of July. If you fancy a different type of crooning, then the Barclaycard Arena on the 27th of July will be host to none less than Celine Dion. And if that's too much for you, why not wind back the clock 20 years to catch Sleeper, The Blue Tones, Dodgy, My Life Story and Salad at the O2 Institute on the 29th of July. And now it's time to close the box. Check out our blog for more links and information on the arts and culture featured in the show at newcuriositiesbox.blogspot.co.uk. My thanks to Idiot Child, Mac Birmingham and Thea Gilmore. The New Curiosities Box is written and presented by me, James Sandy, and is a King of the Buttons production for Switch Radio. I wonder what the strawberry pricing is looking like now.